This is True Tales of Luxury with me, Mariella Frostrup.
In a woman's life, 30 and 50 are very significant. And at 50, I sold everything I had, all of my possessions. I had too many possessions, too many things. And I felt that if I kept them, I wouldn't be able to think a new thought.
Hello, in this series of podcasts from Harrods, I talk to designers and creatives at the forefront of their fields about their life and work and their thoughts about luxury. This week, it's my great pleasure to talk to someone considered to be one of America's most original and influential fashion designers, Norma Kamali. She revolutionized our approach to swimwear and leisure wear. The iconic swimsuit she designed for Farrah Fawcett Major is now in the Smithsonian. She's had far too many awards and accolades to list, and the roll call of famous women who've been dressed by her is a who's who of great women from the 1970s onwards. Welcome to the penthouse suite in Harrods, Norma. You've probably been coming to Harrods since the 60s, have you?
Yeah, I have. I actually started my career because of London.
And really?
Believe it or not, yeah. I graduated from FIT as an illustration major, and my first job interview was a total objectification fiasco, and I remember running out of the office in tears.
What happened?
Well, I had my portfolio, and I was very excited about my first real job interview, no waitressing anymore, that kind of thing. And the guy was sitting with his feet up on a desk eating a tuna sandwich. And he said, you can put your portfolio down over there and come here and turn around for me. And I was so humiliated. And I ran out crying. And I had my big portfolio. And I can remember every detail of it. I was wearing pumps and stockings. And my stockings all ran because the portfolio was great. Everything about it was a nightmare, and I never talked about it until about 10 years ago. That was in my head of like, oh my God, embarrassment, one of the many objectifications women experience in their lives. So I decided I'm just going to get a job in an airline and travel. So there was a office job available at Northwest Airlines. And at the time, airlines were quite the thing, the early 60s,
yeah.
Right? It was like being at Apple or Google or whatever.
And you'd get very dressed up to fly.
Oh, yeah,
and they
yeah.
were really expensive.
Yeah, but every weekend for 4 years, I was in London. And
every
it was $29
weekend.
Round trip.
Wow.
And so my first visit, I was staying at a boarding house off King's Road. This was an artist area at the time, and there were art stores and things like that, and cobblers, just sort of neighborhoody. And everything was gray. It was everything you would think that London was, gray. Everybody had gray tweed, gray herringbone. The streets were gray. The buildings were gray. It was a little gray, rainy.
Oh, dear, it's a monochrome gray, city.
It was. And I was walking, and all of a sudden I hear a sound of music that I'd never heard before. And it was a Beatles song, but I didn't know what that was. It was early 60s. Then I see this color that was so vibrant up the side of a storefront, covering the storefront, and the music is blaring out of the store. And it was like, I'm coming, like, I'm coming to you, I'm coming. And I was like drawn like the light into this place. Every hair of my body was up, and my heart was pounding. I thought, oh my God.
So tell me a bit about the very early days, because I believe that your mother was an incredible seamstress mm-hmm. and made a lot of costumes for you that she recorded for posterity
yes,
in a little Norma's
did.
Book.
Yes, she did. So my mother was extremely talented in every discipline you can think of. She had oil paints going all the time. She was making clothes. She could cook anything that oddly, any type of food. Her artistry for making clothing was really quite amazing, and she made beautiful children's clothes for me. And so every day there was this huge album that she put together. It was Norma's Life in Pictures. And so, you know, how fortunate am I to have that kind of influence growing up.
But she was difficult as well, wasn't she? And I think you credit her with the teaching you had to deal with difficult
women.
Clients,
yeah.
Women.
Yeah, so first of all, she had a huge personality and rightfully so. And she would be far better at being a designer than I am. I'm more of a background person. I'm happy to make everybody else the center of attention. But I did learn a lot from her about how to understand strong personalities and how to really work with women throughout my career. My career has been so female-based. My company, my clients, my world is a very strong female-centric business.
It's interesting that you say, you know, that you're more of a background person. She'd have been a better designer, you know, because she would have been more to the front. But that sort of concept of having to be a brand in that way, in your lifestyle, in your everything, is quite a new one, and certainly wouldn't have been the case when you started out. So do you think it's changed dramatically?
It's changed, and I do credit a little bit of my longevity. I mean, this is my 53rd year as a designer.
It's incredible.
And so
congratulations.
Thank you. But I think because I stayed sort of out of the front of everything, people didn't get tired of me. Do you know what I mean? You can get really tired of somebody who's fabulous and you see a lot of them and you hear a lot of them and it's like, okay, next.
So tell me a bit about, I mean, I remember in the 1980s, for me, you were probably one of the first designers whose name I knew. Everybody wanted something by Norma Kamali, especially swimsuits, but also all the other really pioneering things that you were creating. So how did you go from not being interested in being a fashion designer, looking at some great stuff in London and thinking, wow, this is exciting, I'm interested, to becoming, you know, the Norma Kamali brand? I mean, how did you go about, I think your first shop was when you were 24 years old?
Yeah. So I would come to London every weekend and I would come back with little short skirts on and all these great clothes from Biba and Bus Stop and all these wonderful things I found at Antiquarius. Then my friends were saying, oh, please bring me back some things. And I would go through customs with a big garment bag filled with rolled up clothes with rubber bands around them to make them small to bring them to friends. And then I thought, why don't I just open a shop? So I found a basement store in this little group of brownstones in New York, and it was $285 a month. And I painted the floors and I bought things at the Salvation Army to decorate, and I was bringing clothes back. And then I decided, oh, I have some ideas of things that I would like to do that I don't see anywhere. And I started to make those and begged my mother's help, obviously. And then...
So she taught you to sew then?
Well, I had to learn. I mean, I could make a pair of pants, but I would have to carry a needle and thread because I couldn't put a zipper in. So that was my skill set. I would sew myself into my pants and then try not to drink too much water because it meant I would have to go to the bathroom and re-sew myself in. But so that was my skill set at that point. But then within 6 months... a Vogue editor found my shop and I had a full page in Vogue. And then a Bazaar editor came in and I had a full page in Bazaar. And it was frightening because I thought, I don't know anything. I don't know what I'm doing. I feel like such a fraud. These people are going to find me out. It's like, what do I know? But it was also an incredible inspiration and encouragement to think, wow, maybe this is my path. Maybe this is what I should be doing.
At what point, though, you know, because first you were making sort of fashionable things, perhaps inspired by what you'd seen in London. But when did you start really experimenting, like thinking about different fabrics? You know, you were the first to really use sort of sweat material for you know, proper outfits, and you were one of the first people to use parachute, or in fact, the first person to use parachute silk to make those incredible trousers. Mm-hmm. And I think even Lycra, we may have to blame you
early.
For.
Yes, you do. You do. So because I was sort of in an experimental stage and I didn't have any rules or schooling about design, I would seek out fabrics and things, and I would make coats out of blankets, and I did the sleeping bag coat out of my sleeping bag.
Yeah, so puffer jackets as well is down to you.
So so I was camping and I used my sleeping bag to make a coat, and then I made more coats. And I think of myself more of an inventor than a fashion designer, to be honest. And the 70s were a very free-spirited time. The sweats actually came about when I was doing cover-ups for swim. I was a swimmer, a big swimmer throughout my childhood and even at that time. And I would wear a gray sweatshirt when I got out of the water because I was a hardcore swimmer. And the only place you could buy a sweatshirt like that was at an Army-Navy store for boys and men, a work clothes store. And so I bought gray sweatshirt fabric and I made some swim cover-ups. And then I thought, oh, let me make a skirt. Oh, I can do a dress, or I'll do a gown, I'll do a coat, I'll do a jacket. And so I had 36 pieces in gray sweatshirting. So I contacted Women's Wear Daily and I said, I really need help. Can somebody give me advice? So they came to see it and they said, don't show this to anybody. We're going to help you find a manufacturer to work with. So they found someone for me to meet with. His name was Sidney Kimmel, and he had a company called Jones Apparel, and he was the manufacturer at the time. And so 1979, 1980, gray sweats were very new, very different. We had just come out of Studio 54 and Sparkle and all of that stuff. And now this athletic concept for work and for every day, it had never been seen before.
In a way, you were designing for a new woman who didn't even know that she needed those clothes,
and
weren't
sneakers
you?
And sneakers and so on.
Comfort, comfortable.
Comfort.
We talk a lot about luxury on this podcast. And for me, I think comfort, the ultimate luxury is
comfort.
Is comfort, because you feel confident when you're comfortable. I mean, would it be one of yours?
Yeah. Well, look what I'm wearing. I'm wearing sweats right now.
She's got these great sweatpants on with, they're cargo, like combat. Yeah, they're combat cargo sweats. Very stylish, not just your average sweats. Amazing boots and a very simple black top. You've always gone for very simple lines and things.
Well, I think simple is timeless. And so the idea of sweats and the idea of casual dressing was just really what people were wanting and not knowing they wanted it. And it wasn't like I was a genius and I figured this out. I was just doing cover-ups for my swimwear. And it, you know, it happened to be that way. I was really lucky.
But don't you think that's the way most things happen? It's just that people aren't as self-effacing as you normally. It's like, I invented this, which is perhaps part of a sort of patriarchal culture that, that might be changing.
Mm-hmm. Well, I also think the things that are meant to be are organic and they're not plotted and planned. You can't sort of strategize a new creative thing. You can strategize other things, but creativity is organic.
But turning a lucky chance like that and a bit of chutzpah added in, you know, turning those two things into a huge fashion empire, that's not just luck.
Well, I decided early on what my personal goals were, and I really wanted a creative life. There were opportunities where companies would have wanted to purchase my company or become a partner. And even when those offers were made and I wasn't sure if I could pay the rent the next day, I made the decision not to, because I just didn't want my career to end early. I didn't want to give up the creative life that I was having.
What do you think gave you the sort of tenacity and the self-belief to do that? Because I think it was illustrated very early on when you were married and your husband was your business partner and you decided you needed to get out of that marriage. And you gave up everything because he was your business partner. So you lost your business and your marriage.
Well, first of all, we got married at 19. So that explains a lot.
Do you know him now? Do you see
him? Well, he's passed away, unfortunately.
Sorry.
But and he was a very sweet guy. But he had a series of dating all of our sales girls and buying them gifts and using our money for fabric for other things.
It really had to end.
So it was, and when one of the sales girls told me what she wanted me to make, that she was going to be the designer, and the ceiling over my cutting table fell down, I said to myself, Confucius says, when ceiling falls on head, time to leave. But I only had $98 in the bank because he controlled all the money. We'd separated and I was in an apartment that had a mattress. I didn't have curtains. I really had nothing. And I was so frightened. People didn't really know me because I was always in the sample room sewing and doing my thing, still working at the airline for 4 years. And then,
while you were doing the designing as well.
And then just in the background, and people knew him. And I had an appointment after I left, right? I had an appointment the next day with a woman from a newspaper. And I was, my face was swollen from crying. And she said to me, oh, my goodness, are you okay? What happened to you? And I would never tell anybody about a personal problem. I was just so proud And I just told her everything. And I couldn't believe I was even saying what I was saying. And she said, well, I'm going to help you. And she said, I'm going to get you some sewing machines and we're going to get some help. And then I started to talk to people. And I realized if you tell people what's going on, they can actually help you. And so I learned a lot about communicating at that point. And a lot of people thought I had something and invested, loaned me money, little bits here and there. And then I opened a store and I paid everybody back something each week because I wanted them to know that I would never take advantage of what they had done for me.
So those were the darker days, but then the 1980s in New York was a really exciting time, wasn't it? And you were right in the thick of it. Mm-hmm. You were the designer du jour. You were at Studio 54. You were friends with Ian Schrager. And how did it feel at that point, you know?
Well, Ian and I were actually dating. We were together, but I never went to Studio 54.
Really? How come?
Well, first of all, I've never done drugs and I don't drink.
You've never drunk?
No. So if you go to Studio 54 and you're not stoned, it's not a good thing. It could be very overwhelming.
To lend a dance saber.
Yeah. But we were together for that period of time. And so after work, I would go to Studio to see what he had done and what he'd planned for the parties. And I would have parties for my company before Studio opened. So we would have dance parties and do things like that.
But you never, ever went. Weren't you a little bit curious just to, you know, one night pop in and see Mick and Bianca?
No. I was dressing everybody that was there, clearly. But it wasn't what I was so happy that I was doing what I was doing. My sleeping bag coats were outside trying to get in.
And the sleeping bag coats were on the bouncers, weren't they?
Yeah, they were on. Steve Rubell wore my sleeping bag coat. So I was very happy in my world. I knew everything that was going on because I was with Ian, but who is still my best friend and who's introduced me to my soulmate, by the way, that I met when I was 65. So Ian is still my best friend. That's our connection. You know,
That's such a lovely story. Well, at what point do you think you understood the identity of who you were as a designer?
I understood that the way I worked best was to just do Norma. If there's a trend, that's good. Let that happen. But just keep doing me.
It's so funny you say that, because this morning I Googled just to have a look at, you know, some of the things you're doing now, you know, because I was remembering nostalgically this grey dress I had in the 80s and thinking, where did, grey sweat dress, mm-hmm. and thinking, where did that end up? I had no idea that, you know, all those clothes you lose over the years, it's so upsetting. And there was this jumpsuit and I just had to buy it.
I'm so glad.
So I bought something from you probably 35 years ago. And yeah. Today.
It's very interesting. I have new people now. They're young girls. They're women who are in their 20s and 30s. They don't know that I did a sleeping bag coat or sweats. Why should they know that, right? And I'm perfectly okay with that. I feel great when I see this sort of energy towards what I'm doing and that it doesn't have anything to do with my history. And then there are women who are in their 80s who were buying clothes for me that are older than I am, who still have memories about Norma Kamali clothes.
And what would you say the elements of your clothing are? If I had to describe to someone who's never seen anything you've designed, what would you say the elements are?
Comfort. Everything I do, you can wash and is easy. I think my clothes are timeless, but I also think they're fun.
You've worked forever in the field, a luxurious field, if you will, in the field of fashion. I wondered what for you you regard as luxurious. What are your luxuries?
Well, as you can see, I'm not wearing any jewelry. I'm not a high maintenance person. I think luxury to me is taking care of yourself, doing things for yourself. So what's luxury for me is to take an hour out every day to work out. What's luxury for me is to buy good food that's healthy, and to take the time to make a healthy smoothie for myself and to do things like that, to have a great massage and to really do self-care. I work extremely hard. When you own a business, you may put your head on the pillow, but I know in my dreams I'm still working. My health and my wellness are the luxury that I indulge in.
Have you changed the way you dress over your life? I mean, I know that I keep having moments of crisis where I think, well, I'm 48, you know, should I be wearing that? Oh, I'm 54. Mm. I don't think I should be wearing that, you know.
No, I never do. No, that would never, my age would never determine what I decide to wear. I really believe that it's not the clothes. It's always you first, right? So my clothes don't define me. I have a British personality in the typical. I'm very sober, very grounded, but I'm a little off. I'm a little off the edge, right? And so that's, to me, if you describe a Brit, that's, and how great is that? So that's the way I present myself in the way I dress, too.
You gave up wearing makeup at the age, I don't know what age you were, actually, but it was in 1993, so it was quite some time ago. And I think that prompted you to design a very small but sort of perfectly formed range of creams that you use. Why did you give up wearing makeup?
So I was about to turn 50 in 1995. When you turn 50, I think it's in a woman's life, 30 and 50 are very significant. And at 50, I sold everything I had, all of my possessions. I had too many possessions, too many things.
And you cleared out everything.
Everything. And so I...
What did you keep?
I just got rid of everything. I had an incredible townhouse. I had all of these things. And I felt that if I kept them, I wouldn't be able to think a new thought. all of the clothes that I'd saved from every collection I got rid of. And still today, I don't save anything. If I'm not reading the book, I pass it on. If I'm obviously my music isn't in albums or anything anymore. And so I give away what I'm not using. And so my life is very simple. So when it came to how I presented myself, I felt makeup, I'm talking about face makeup, was looking like I was trying to hide the aging process. And I am not an anti-aging person or anti-wrinkle person. This is quite frankly something I want to show, but I obviously want to look healthy and I want my skin to look good and I want my eyes to sparkle and my hair to shine. So I created this brand, Norma Kamali Life, which is democratic and inclusive, and the skin line represents that.
And you created that at 74, or just in the last few years.
Yeah.
So, I mean, I think that, you know, you're really quite remarkable as well, just in your attitude to working life, that I presume it's something that you really enjoy, mm-hmm. that you've got no intention of giving up.
At 74 and post-menopause, when women think of themselves as sort of, you know, age gracefully, go out to pasture or whatever
quiet,
it is.
Stay in the background.
And because you're not as pretty as you used to be, there are lines on your face, you don't have that spunky step. I think healthy lifestyle is a very important topic of conversation for women from 40 on. I mean, for a lifetime, but from 40 on,
I
it's
so
very
agree.
Important because if you live a healthy lifestyle, your ability to fulfill dreams and your potential in this life is key to how you live. It describes who you are every day. And so I don't see a lack of opportunity for myself. I have plans of things I'm doing next for Norma Life and all the things that I'm doing for my company. Like I said, I met my soulmate at 65. I still have the spirit I want. Now, there are a lot of young girls that are 30 who don't have that spirit. And I think if everybody understands what their purpose is in this lifetime, now you may not realize it at 20 or whenever, but to focus on what that purpose is, it keeps you steered in the right direction. And if you try for a healthy lifestyle, you may have the ability to keep reaching for that potential and do things you never expected in your life.
We're just coming to the close of this fascinating conversation on your part, not so much on mine. But I wondered about the luxury item that you've brought along today, something that you really consider to be the ultimate luxury for you.
Well, I think the ultimate luxury for me is the potential to dream and to fulfill a dream. It's not a thing or a place. It's more of optimism, of waking up every day, no matter how awful the day before was, and there are some awful days, that today is another chance to make something happen in a positive way.
So your luxury item is yourself,
mm-hmm.
your own psyche.
My dreams.
Your dreams. Has there ever been a point where, you know, you sound like you're an incredible survivor. I'm sure there's been lots of knocks along the way.
Oh, yeah, for sure.
What's the worst thing? When was the moment when you really didn't know if you were going to be able to pick yourself up?
There were many. There's not one worse one, to be honest. When you're in, especially in a business for 53 years, you at least have a few a decade. The early knocks are the hardest because you don't have any life experience. The more knocks you have, the faster you get up and change it. So the key is when you get knocked down, don't stay down for too long because it gets so much harder to get up. You can cry, but then, okay, stop, enough. get up and then, like, what are you going to do? How are you going to fix this? What are you going to do to prevent this from happening again? So, and tomorrow I'm going to have another knock. You know, it's, I didn't live all my knocks yet. They're still happening there, and there's more to come. But as you get older, you're wiser and you do figure out solutions faster.
More resilient.
Yeah, yeah, it's true.
So as a gift to you for coming in today to talk to me, I'm going to let you run rampant through Harrods, any department you want to go to, anything you want. Where would you go?
I don't need anything. I really don't need anything. When you say that, I think of getting something for other people because I have everything I need. I certainly don't need clothes and I don't need shoes. I think I would probably get a gift for somebody else, probably for my soulmate. There are a lot of things I could get him, but I would probably look around and see.
So I'm going to liberate you now, and you can wander the departments of Harrods and see what catches your eye to your heart's content. Thank you very much, Norma Kamali.
Thank you.
You've been listening to True Tales of Luxury with me, Mariella Frostrup, and my guest, Norma Kamali. Next week, I'll be talking to the luxury chocolatier, William Curley, about the night bus to Paris and what makes the best chocolate in the world. This series is recorded in Harrods in London.